All right, so as Dr. Giacello mentioned, this is one of the chapters of my dissertation, which focuses on upstream determinants of Latino health. So I've been really excited to be part of a panel with such diverse perspectives, and I'm excited to think about the ways that that our things link together. So I'll be looking at this topic by looking at an event in my home state, Iowa, as kind of a natural experiment that might reveal some of the dynamics between immigration enforcement and health. And it's important, especially, you know, we're in the Latino caucus here, that I want to highlight that I'm thinking about this as immigration enforcement affecting not just immigrant Latinos' health, but also the health of U.S.-born Latinos. So to begin, I have no relationship to disclose. I'm coming at this work from a structural determinants of health perspective, so I'm excited to be part of a Health in All Policies conference. There was a great panel yesterday on immigration enforcement and immigrant and refugee health. Speakers did a great job of laying out some of those relationships, and today I'm excited to extend it to think about the effects for U.S.-born Latino health. So I'm going to briefly review it here. Immigration policy, just to, so we're all on the same page, I'm going to define it as something that can happen at the federal, state, or local level, something that's constantly changing. And generally, we could think about it as the set of rules that define who's allowed to live and work in this country and what rights and services they are entitled to. And we can think about immigration policy having upstream influence on conditions for immigrants, social determinants of health for immigrants, so working conditions, day-to-day fear of detainment and deportation, access to public services like healthcare, education, protection from law enforcement, and experiences of social exclusion and marginalization. And it's important also to think about the fact that these effects on immigrants operate not just at the individual level, but also at the family and community level. So I was thinking about how some of the factors that your study looks at with family cohesion, family conflict, that would be something that might be influenced by immigration and policy enforcement within a family. Also, religious involvement and social support, some of those same factors. You know, we could think about the ways that immigration policy affects people's feeling of security, going to church, finding social support. And then, as I mentioned, we can also think about immigration policy and social determinants of health having an influence on conditions for U.S.-born Latinos. And that's largely because we live in a society right now where immigration is a racialized conversation. And so immigrants are racialized as Latinos, Latinos are racialized as immigrant, even though that's very much not the case. In fact, several years ago now, all Latino population, or the majority of Latino population growth in this country is from births, not from migration. So it's people born here as American as any other U.S.-born person. So that we can think about the influence on conditions for U.S.-born Latinos happening through family, community, and economic connections to immigration-related stressors, and also through structural racism. So immigration policy is sending messages to the population about what America is, who belongs here, and sometimes that gets perpetuated through programs, and then also it can legitimize discrimination between individuals. People hear those messages from their government and feel like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to believe about my country, too. And then lastly, there's specific immigration bills. There's many, but I think the most famous ones would be the example of SB 1070 in Arizona. People called it a show me your papers bill, which basically said as law enforcement, you're allowed to ask someone for your papers if you suspect them of being undocumented, which often people are founding those suspicions on the way someone looks. So to test the relationship between immigration enforcement and health, I chose to look at low birth weight as a health outcome, and I did that for a number of reasons. First of all, we know that low birth weight is sensitive to maternal psychosocial stresses, which is probably an important mechanism by which immigration enforcement might affect health. And then secondly, there's good evidence about the ways rates of low birth weight respond to environmental stressors. So there's great literature coming out of mostly demography and economics looking at these big population level stressors like earthquakes, terrorist attacks, other kinds of armed conflict and natural disasters. And you see at a population level a rise in low birth weight, which is an unhealthy health outcome in itself and also has implications for the child's health later in their life. Just recently, there was a paper that came out about rates of low birth weight going up after job losses were announced. So in anticipation of a threat to your income, that was also something that responded to low birth weight responded to it. And my kind of exposure for this paper is an immigration raid that happened in Postville, Iowa in 2008. Who in the room knows about it already, just so I have a sense? It was May 12, 2008. Actually, Christina and I were working together in Iowa at the time with migrant agricultural workers. And it's a famous raid. There's a lot I'd like to say about it. I need to be brief today. But at the time, it was the largest single-site immigration and customs enforcement raid in U.S. history. There's been one larger since. It occurred at a meat processing plant where that star is in northeast Iowa. 900 ICE agents were deployed. They arrested 389 workers, of whom 98% were Latino. Of those arrested, 297 were deported. Many of those who weren't deported were still kept with an ankle monitor, weren't allowed to work, were allowed to stay because they had children here, but were effectively, you know, jailed in their own town. And there's a lot of things we could say about Postville. I think the things I want to highlight today are the ways that it is not terribly different from immigration enforcement that we still see happening today. So there's things about it that were kind of crazy. It was a huge raid. It happened at a kosher meat processing plant. You can read about it. But there's also things about it that are very typical. So I have this picture to talk about. Immigration enforcement today is militarized, and so was the Postville raid. So the helicopter that they used when they circled around that plant was effectively a military Black Hawk helicopter. It's the civilian version of that. Much like Border Patrol today on the border is armed and operates as a military organization. Similarly, immigrants in Postal were criminalized, much like contemporary programs like Secure Communities or Priority Enforcement Program that link immigration enforcement with law enforcement. Immigrants who were detained in Postville were not just deported, but first charged with aggravated identity theft, which is a felony charge. They were forced to serve a prison sentence before being deported. And that affects their ability to return to this country. It also kept them away from supporting their families, which for many of them was the reason they were in Iowa in the first place. The use of racial profiling in the Postville raid is also typical. So the many accounts are that when ICE entered that plant that day, they sorted people by the way they looked, and that's how they decided to go through and identify documentation status. And as I mentioned with bills in Arizona and elsewhere, that is not uncommon. And then lastly, fast-track deportations. So in Postville, they had so many people they had detained that they tried people in groups of 10. And basically just tried to deport them as quickly as possible. And that, unfortunately, is also not unique. So Project Streamline on the border also works in that way to deport people in groups. And you may have read about the process for deporting undocumented Central American youth last summer, and it was also similar. So there's ways Postville is, in this case, a big event, which makes it easy to study scientifically, but I want to think about also the ways that it can help us think about those small immigration raids that are happening in homes and in workplaces every day. Some of what we see here might also be, we can extend it to those situations. The last way that Postville is definitely typical of immigration enforcement is fear. And it was, I think we could call it a terrorist attack. This is a photo from Postville in a church, actually. So think about religious coping. You know, even that space that was supposed to be a sanctuary was kind of scary for people. You can see people hiding their faces. And that's also true of immigration enforcement today. And important for my presentation today is to think about the way that fear happens not just to people, you know, in the town of Postville, but people who are maybe even hours away but work in a town that feels the same. They feel connected to that place. And in Iowa, there's a lot of towns that would feel connected to Postville. Meat processing, which is where that plant, where the raid took place, is common in Iowa, and especially at the time of the raid, most of the meat processing workforce was immigrant and Latino. This was only 18 months after the ICE raids on Swift plants throughout the country in December 2006. So again, another reason that if you worked in meat processing, you would feel connected to the risk of deportation yourself. So to talk more about the effects throughout the state, I'm just showing an assortment of headlines from the state of Iowa around that time. So this is from Waterloo, Iowa, about a two-hour drive from Postville. This is a headline from Ottumwa, where Dr. Vaquero does work, about 5 hours from Postville. And then other headlines, you know, from throughout the state. They're also, you know, it was in Northeast, but I also saw headlines about Western Iowa, people in meat processing towns feeling affected. And that wasn't just a psychosocial effect. There was also material effects. So people put in a lot of energy into legal costs, putting their papers in order in case there was a follow-up raid in their town, making plans for where your children would go, And even, you know, reining in your own spending, maybe, you know, scrimping a bit on groceries or healthcare or whatever as you prepare for possibly being needing to be the next person to leave. And then another thing that's important is to think about institutional responses to the raid. So this is a headline from Perry, Iowa, which is in the center of the state, near the state capital of Des Moines. And this was, I saw headlines like this from other towns too, where the town's mayor was being asked, are we going to be the next Postville? What is our town like? So they would in turn go to the meat processing employer and ask, what is your employment? Are you hiring people who might be subject to a similar raid? And then there were also reports that employers changed their hiring practices after that. And again, were sometimes just hesitant to hire Latinos at all, regardless of documentation status, because they were feeling like that might put them at risk of being the next site of a raid. So I go through all of that just to say that I think that this had effects throughout the state of Iowa, and that's important to how I'm going to test it as I go forward. So I'm thinking about Postville as an epidemiologic exposure. It's kind of an external shock to the environment in Iowa, which already had anti-immigrant, anti-Latino things going on, but might have been exaggerated after a raid like that because of the processes I've been describing. It happened with very little warning to anyone locally. It had effects locally and throughout the state, and, you know, as I've been saying, effects on both immigrant and U.S.-born Latinos. So I'm going to, as with those papers I mentioned before that looked at earthquakes, terrorist attacks, I'm going to compare the risk of low birth weight in the state of Iowa before and after the raid. And my hypotheses are that among infants born to white mothers, we will not see an effect. However, among infants born to immigrant and U.S.-born Latina mothers, I think we will see that kind of population stress effect where rates of low birth weight go up. So to look at this, I used birth certificate data, which is a wonderful publicly available source of data. And for this, I restricted to singleton births. I excluded multiples because they have different birth weights. And because of the small sample size of other ethnic groups, I restricted to white and Latina mothers. And then the way I tested this before-after thing is I looked at infants born in the 37 weeks following the Postville raid. That's the length of a normal gestation. So I was trying to capture babies who were in utero during that post-raid environment. And there's seasonality in low birth weight over the course of the year. So our comparison group was babies born during that exact same time of year, but 1 year earlier. And for descriptive purposes, I even looked 2 years earlier as well. And then the analysis is a modified Poisson regression, which operates just the same as logistic regression, except it allows you to estimate risk ratios. And I use that to compare the risk of low birth weight before and after the raid. And then the real hypothesis is about effect modification. So I don't think that effect is going to happen in the whole state. I think the effect of the raid is going to depend on whether you are white or Latina. And so I tested, it's a difference in differences analysis using like an interaction term to see if the effect of the raid differed for Latina women from white women. And then secondarily, I split Latina women by their place of birth, U.S. born and immigrant. There might have been changes in the group of women having babies during this time, so I also adjusted for features of the mothers that might be related to low birth weight, age, education, marital status, and parity. And then lastly, I adjusted for behavioral factors that are on a birth certificate that maybe mediated the effect of the raid. So perhaps fewer women accessed prenatal care, or more women took up smoking because they were so stressed out. So I, as the last model, I tested if that helped explain any of the effects. I'm going to move quickly through the description because I want to have time to talk about the results. But I think the main thing I want to highlight here is you can see we have our before the raid group on the left, after the raid group on the right. And the main thing to point out is that the proportion of babies that were born to Latina moms is steady across the time period. Some people thought maybe Latina moms would have left the state and we'd see a drop after the raid, but we don't, which isn't surprising because it's a federal raid, so leaving Iowa isn't going to make you safer, unfortunately. And then if I look by nativity, you can see again that both before and after the raid, about two-thirds of Latina moms having babies were immigrant versus one-third were U.S.-born. Again, there's not time to go through the whole table, but this is the covariates I talked about. By ethnicity and nativity, and then before and after, there's interesting differences between ethnicity and nativity, but the main thing to look at is actually the before and after, so you don't see changes within each group according to the marital status, whether it's their first birth or not, prenatal care, things like that. So it suggests that the group of women having babies before the raid and after the raid are similar. This is my descriptive graph. So this is going back 2 years. So you can see on the far right, that's the rate of global earthquake. So that's the y-axis after the coastal raid. And you can compare it to the 2 years before. And what you can see is for white women, the blue line, it stays steady. But for both immigrant and U.S.-born Latino women, you see this jump in the rates of low birth weight. So that suggests we're seeing what we thought we might see. They are smaller groups of people, so maybe it's just volatile low birth weight, and that's why you have to test it statistically to see is that a meaningful jump, or is that just something that happens when you have a smaller population group. So these are the results of the regression. So for this, the left axis is the risk ratio. And that's comparing the risk of low birth weight after the raid to the risk of low birth weight before the raid. So for white, infants born to white mothers, you can see there's no difference. It stands the null value. But for infants born to Latino moms, there's a 30% higher risk of low birth weight after the raid compared to before. And that is statistically significant. If we split it by nativity, you can see that the effects are strong in both groups. The confidence intervals get wider because it's a smaller group. But the effect is consistent across those two groups, which is some of that effect of immigration enforcement on U.S.-born Latinas that I was mentioning before. This is unadjusted, to account for the fact that maybe things changed in the group of women having babies, I adjusted for maternal education, parity, age, and marital status, and the results were very similar. And then to look at whether any of that effect was mediated by changes in prenatal care utilization or smoking, I adjusted for them as well. And this is the kind of fully adjusted model, and again, the results are stable. So that's my final result. Talk about the strengths and the limitations of this study. I think that the strongest thing is that, you know, immigration enforcement is really hard to measure. There's lots of people thinking about great ways to do it. But this is one way to do it that it's a little crude, but it because the raid was so big, you can actually see some of these more dramatic effects that are harder to measure when there's just like little post fills going on every day, you know, 4 and 5 people having their post fill, but not anything where you can really measure it as a researcher very easily. And then secondly, I'm excited about birth certificate data because unlike a lot of health surveys, you're likely to get a birth certificate regardless of your documentation status, whereas you might be more hesitant to talk to a researcher or participate in a survey if you're undocumented. And limitation of this is I don't have individual level measure of stressor exposure, so I don't know, you know, there could be women in this data set who had no idea post-bill had happened or thought they weren't affected by it. I'm just looking at the whole state and I can't look at that, you know, did you feel affected by it? And then lastly, as Dr. Cavazza mentioned, there's great heterogeneity in Hispanic subgroups. Iowa has its own interesting array of people from all over the world. And just because of sample size, I looked very crudely just at place of birth to divide the very, very diverse group of people living in Iowa. So to sum up, after postal, we observed increased risk of low birth weight among babies born to foreign-born and U.S.-born Latina mothers. We couldn't explain this by confounders or by those behavioral mediators. So that leaves us to think about some of the things I described in the beginning. So psychosocial stressors that might have mediated that change, fear of follow-up raids, planning for future raids. And then there were reports of increased discrimination against Latinos in the state, both in employment and in personal interactions, and heightened identity threat, which is what they call, you know, going about your business and being aware of who you are, how you're perceived to people. And then lastly, perhaps economic stress, so uncertainty about your job or reduced activity at businesses. It's important to acknowledge my wonderful collaborators, Arlene Geronimus and Aresha Martinez Cardoso. These are my funders. And then lastly, I've gotten incredible insight, encouragement, and support from CIRLI, the Coalition for Interdisciplinary Research of Latina and Latino Issues at Michigan, the Center for Social Epidemiology and Population Health, and the Department of Community and Behavioral Health at the University of Iowa, where I've been visiting for the last year. Thanks so much.
Okay, we have a few minutes for questions. So the speaker could come to the front, and if they could just be able to respond to questions. Any question to any of the presenters? Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. I wanted to ask the presenters about the Latino mental health. I just wasn't clear. Did the study show more anxiety for men or women?
More anxiety for women.
Okay. And social support is a very significant factor. Was that more for men or women, or that was
it was more for the men, and you can see that social support is not only for like within the family, but it's also what you get from the neighbors and for work friends.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of negative family interactions, did you look at intimate partner violence at all?
That was one of the limitations. It was not in the
romantic involvement and family or partnership violence was not included. It's okay. Very good for thinking about that.
Yeah. And was family bonding a protective factor for the men and the women?
Both.
Family bonding?
Was.
Was that a protective factor for mental health? Both the men and the women?
It depends on which diagnosis, but in general, yes.
So more bonding among the females than the males, because the males are more the money that brings.
So bonding among Latina women or family bonding was more protective for Latina women, or both?
The bonding, yes. The interaction with whole family, it doesn't matter whether female or male.
Okay.
It's protective for women, not for men.
Thank you.
Any other question?
Actually, no, it's really under review. We are going through some changes in the violence group and really understanding, actually more of the literature, because I've seen some new findings, new studies coming out, and the time of that relationship in that thing. So stay tuned. But I'm happy to talk.
Yeah, a third question? Any other question in the back?
Study of the community sample, you know, and I think what they saw was after we had success with this intervention and they saw how wonderful our community health workers did in terms of implementing the intervention, they were like, how do we prove this works, you know, how do we show that this is a great model, how do we take the next step? And so, you know, I think that's where we were able to say, well, there's a way to do that. Our first randomized control trial was a 6-month delayed intervention. So everybody got the intervention. In the second randomized trial, we really wanted to look at the longer term effects, the sustained effect of the intervention. So that's why, again, we didn't use a pure control group. We used sort of, as Randy mentioned, we used an enhanced usual care group. And we're able to talk to our partners and say, you know, if you believe in the care that you're giving people as good care, we're not giving them any less by putting them in a control group. You know, we're giving them what you usually give them and a little bit more. And they're able to say, oh, well, put it that way, that makes sense, you know? So it was, in both cases, it wasn't a true control group where they received nothing. So those are some of the strategies that we used.
Any further questions?
I have just had a follow-up question, Dr. And I'm just kind of curious, because it depends. 10 sessions, 2 hours long, bi-weekly. So I know that for a lot of where I work at, you know, retention can be a problem. So do you kind of have an idea of like what the retention rate was for the short graduation rate?
Yeah, our retention rate was actually pretty good. Not everybody attended all the classes, though. And that's where the community health workers came in oftentimes with their home visits to deliver the classes one-on-one with people. We actually did do a little bit of a study to see if the one-on-one and the group made a difference. And actually, the group classes made it work, did better over the group classes than the one-on-one. We did the opposite, but the group classes, we did better. But yeah, it was a problem. You know, people often miss classes and
then,
Yeah, there was incentives, but only for data collection.
Okay, very good. We ran out of time, so please ask any additional questions to them individually. Thank you so much. Thank a hands of applause for the presenter for stimulating our thoughts and discussion. Thank you. Great presentation.